RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Remember, last Monday we started a new series here on RCR, which will run for some weeks, and it's called What is Money? And Joel Robinson of Radical Investment in Wellington is taking us through what money is. We kind of had a general episode last Monday, sort of setting the table for what's to come, talking a bit of history, etc. So this is episode two, What is Money? And it's really around a history of currency. And Joel is with us. Hi, Joel. Thanks for coming back for this series. It's starting to get interesting.
My pleasure, Paul. Yeah, first one, a bit of a prelude, talking about some technical terms, but we get to talk a bit of history today, story time.
Okay, I love stories. Everyone loves a good story.
Exactly.
And this is probably one of the most, I don't know, well, it's an amazing story, money, currency, exchange. It's sort of foundational to human civilization, really, isn't it?
Yep.
I mean, we really wouldn't be here where we are now without this ability to exchange and to know what does and does not have value.
Yeah, I mean, we would basically be still in a barter system where you're growing carrots and I'm growing tomatoes and we're trading them, and we probably don't know anyone other than the people that are about 5 to 10 Ks radius from us, whereas today, obviously, life's very different to that. And wouldn't be that way without money.
Everyone is, and that's the problem a bit these days too. Too many people know where we are. You can track us. Okay, so let's recap on last week's episode. First, the functions of money maybe is a good place to start.
Yeah, so to kind of cover it briefly, really encourage people to go back and listen to that episode to dive into the detail. But basically, there's three main functions of money. One is a medium of exchange, so that it's something held for the primary purpose of acquiring something else in time. It's, you know, held temporarily. It's not really like an end goal. Secondly, it's a store of value, so meaning it lasts physically. So we used the example of tomatoes, not a great store of value. They go rotten after a period of time. And then the second part of store of value is something that holds its value over time. So something could last indefinitely, but not necessarily hold value to other people over time.
Right.
And then the third part is that it's a unit of account. So that involves being widely accepted, which currently is, I guess, one of the barriers for Bitcoin in particular, which we'll get to in a few episodes time. But yeah, it being widely accepted is a key thing for people deeming it to be how they account for different things. So like, you know, New Zealand dollar, really commonly used. So it's a unit of account for value of different things. So those are those three main functions. And then we talk about what
it has to be. Sorry, I was just going to say, because it has legal, well, on the cash it does, legal tender.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That is such a big part of it as well. There has to be some, okay, there's an accepted confidence, a widespread confidence that it is something of value, but it's underpinned by a sort of like a status that helps for everyone to have that confidence and agreement. And in this case, legal tender.
Yeah.
It meets that benchmark, right?
Yeah, there's a couple of ways that it can gain status, and it can be through, you know, by decree, but it can also just be because it meets a lot of the functions of being good money. And that can be things like saleability, which we talked about in the first episode. So saleability is three different things. One, it's scale, so how well it can, you know, you can divide it, basically. So like huge boulders, not the most scalable things, but difficult to divide into small pieces. Location, so like how well it is, how easy it is to transport. Again, something very large and heavy, like elephants, not particularly great from a location point of view. And then what makes good something saleable is that it's saleable over time as well. And that last thing we talked about and spent a little bit of time on is talking about stock to flow ratios, and it'll come up again a little bit today. But basically, stock being the existing supply or amount of a currency, and flow being the new creation of it. So high stock to flow ratio, meaning there's a high stock relative to the new creation on a regular basis. Having a low stock to flow ratio is the opposite. So it could be that the supply is even dwindling, and that can happen due to perishability. So going back to tomatoes, you had a ton of tomatoes. Yeah. Well, that stock's going to diminish because either it's consumed or it goes rotten. and the flow, the ability to create, you know, if all of a sudden there was a not tulip bulb mania, it was tomato mania. Everyone and their aunt would be producing tomatoes in the backyard and the value would fall because it's very easy to ramp up massive production unlike tomatoes. So would have a very low.
You mentioned the tulip bulb madness. That was Netherlands, wasn't it? I don't know what century that was in, but that's always interesting me now that you brought it up because
yeah.
I wonder, you know, what was the value seen in that? I'm just... You couldn't really eat them, could you?
No, it was because I think, from my understanding, they were somewhat rare and sought after at the time, and from looking back at the relatively average historical records that exist of kind of people's thinking at the time, it's unclear why so many people kind of began speculating on it. Like today's day and age, people go, oh, you know, this is the next thing, like the whole NFTs craze from a couple of years ago. People were buying it because everyone else was buying it. But it's not clear that actually the tulip bulb mania was driven by a huge amount of speculation with the same intent as a lot of that sort of speculation occurs today. But the impact was, yeah, it was nuts because... that was a good example of something with a really low stock flow ratio. It's very easy money, if you could call it money, because it's very easy to produce tulip bulbs relative, you know,
right.
if everyone deems it to be highly valuable, everyone starts producing them, market's flooded, no longer valuable. And so the value peaks and absolutely troughs down again. Yeah.
Yeah. Also, you got me thinking about a few other things. And if you take slave labor out of the mm-hmm. equation, so forcing people to do things.
Yep.
Some of the huge, sort of ancient, and when I say ancient, you know, back 1,000 years before, yes. infrastructure projects. I'm thinking of, you know, some of the structures built, the pyramids,
yes.
the Easter Island statues. Obviously, a huge amount of work was required in constructing those, transporting, well, in the case of the statues, from wherever they were made to wherever they were placed on that island. And half buried. And then I'm thinking of the pyramids, you know, millions of huge rocks transported over huge distances, same with Stonehenge. There must have been something in the value of those things.
Yeah.
And take slave labor out of it. And there would have been an element of that, I would imagine, that was able to find the funding for it or the exchange to make those things happen. They must have been of extreme value to people for that to happen, I'm just thinking.
Yeah. Well, I mean, some people might make the argument that because there were slaves involved, there was little to no cost. But at the same time, there is a valid point there in that, well, they could be doing something else instead. Just because it was slave labor doesn't mean that it's then just automatically easy. I mean, there's always a cost, and the cost is what they could be doing instead. So, yeah, I imagine a lot of that has actually been lost time. A lot of it would be probably cultural. But yeah, they are fascinating projects.
They had to be funded somehow in the, you know, in the sort yes. of the mechanistic sense that there must have been some exchange.
Yeah.
That made that. Anyway, it's a bit older and bigger than tulip bulbs, but maybe the same.
It does.
There was like a pyramid mania or something. We've got to be in on this.
Yeah.
Start off small, right. Get big.
The first pyramid scheme.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, totally. We're not talking about the food pyramid, no.
Yeah.
All right, so should we get on to the history of currency? And I'm trying to imagine what the first item of currency was. I mean, there must have been a moment, a first hander over something in exchange that kind of was the beginning of currency.
Yeah, it was most likely something basic needs related. Before we started recording, you indicated probably some food. I'd say probably right. Seeds, maybe.
Yeah.
Could be some form of weapon, maybe some item of clothing or shelter, but almost certainly it'd be something related to basic needs because we're talking very, you know, primitive, basic societies, cultures. You're not having all this high technology.
Weapon would make sense. I know food makes sense, but you can go out and catch your own food.
Yeah.
Seeds, possibly, depending on where you are in the world, how easy it is to go out and catch food. But weapons, they would give you a huge advantage over the people over the hill or whatever.
Yeah.
And that would be worth exchanging something for of significant value.
Well, there are definitely cases historically and even more recent to that. Like I believe when the Spanish came to South America, there was often exchanges of weapons for primary goods and valuable resources, etc. So it was probably somewhat similar. But we will we'll chart a slightly different path in our discussion of the some of the historic lessons. So I've got a couple of good ones for you today, which I found particularly fascinating when I was learning about them. But to preface this, I did want to make a statement which I think is worth people dwelling on and does lead into the future conversations that we'll have, which is when easy money encounters hard money, or when a culture that uses easy money, because it's not always the interaction of the two types of money, it's the byproduct of that, easy money has always eventually lost.
I see.
And the reason for that is because the harder money becomes more sought out by people. If I was to say, hey, let's start money, it's going to be pieces of plastic. What a stupid idea. It's so easy. Plastic's everywhere. It's a poor form of money. So a society that was operating in the modern day on a plastic standard, where they were buying and selling things in terms of plastic, it would be pretty easy to extract a lot of the valuable wealth, the real wealth, out of such a society. And many of the cases throughout history mimic this. There's so many different types of money throughout history that have been used, but gold and silver, which are well known, copper, seashells even, large stones, which we'll talk about, salt, cattle. Anecdotally on cattle, I spent a year in South Sudan about 12 years ago. Cattle was used as a form of dowry. And it's used in some other countries as a form of dowry. Government paper, which is basically what we have today. Precious stones, glass beads, and in prisons, alcohol and cigarettes, commonly used as currency.
Yeah, well, that's because it's addictive, right? And people want it, need it. Yep.
So, yeah, the first of the two of the stories for today is story of Rai stones, R-A-I stones, from a place called Yap Island, which sounds like a made-up story, but it's a real place that's part of modern-day Micronesia. Federated States of Micronesia. Mm-hmm. They used to quarry limestone from neighboring Palau and would ship it on some very labor-intensive boats, often involving even hundreds of people to get them across. So there was a real effort involved in the mining, the quarrying of that limestone. And what they would do is they would bring that stone into the town center. Everyone would essentially be present there, be called and made aware of whose stone it was. So if everyone is aware of whose it is, it makes it virtually impossible to steal. Additionally, if it weighs 4 tons, it's pretty damn hard to steal.
You try getting away with that.
Especially if you don't really have the technology like cranes, modern cranes, etc., that we do to be able to move it. So it was quite effective as a form of currency, because when they did a transaction, they could just convene people and say, this is now Bob. It's Bob's stone. It's no longer mine, and Bob has paid me something for it. Everyone knows, okay, yeah, that's right, that's Bob's now. And so that system worked for them quite well for potentially centuries. It's actually unknown when it started like that. But as you can imagine, as we look at that now, if we encountered a society that was, running a economy on that sort of standard of using huge blocks of limestone, you could imagine how susceptible that economy would be. And so in 1871, there was a guy called David O'Keefe who was shipwrecked there, an Irish-American guy. And there's actually a film apparently made on this, which I haven't seen, but it was made in the 1960s. So it's not going to be, your 4K super high definition resolution if you want to go and watch it. But on the story where he shipwrecked there, found they had a lot of coconuts. Coconut oil was valuable at the time. He wanted to try to find a way for them to produce it, but couldn't incentivize them with the money and resources that he had, because that was not how they operated. So what he found out was about these limestones. He went across to Hong Kong, got some boats, got some dynamite, went and quarried a bunch of this limestone.
Yep.
Which obviously the Yappese people did not have dynamite. Mm-hmm. Quarried a bunch of it, took it over there and exchanged it for some of the natural resources they had. And actually, it's kickstarted essentially, it very quickly turned into essentially a destruction of that economy, because they found that their money was no longer hard money. It was no longer difficult to produce as it had been for them for centuries. So it was, that would have been quite a thing to encounter for a whole people, to suddenly have their entire way of life challenged because their form of money just was completely undermined.
Yeah, how do you deal with that, I wonder? I mean, obviously they did, but I wonder how you deal with that when it suddenly is upon you.
Well, it's messy, frankly. But typically it's better for it to be sudden like that than it to be slow and long. And that's really the second story I have for you today, which is out of West Africa. They used to produce glass, these glass beads, or had these glass beads called agri beads. This is in the 16th century. And they were quite good as a form of money, because if you imagine with glass beads, fairly portable, you know, much lighter than obviously a 4-ton stone, you can operate a larger economy or something like that. They can be effectively worn, which, you know, is quite helpful too. Very divisible, because, you know, you could obviously trade 10 or 1 or 2. You're not have to get out a chisel and hammer to, you know, carve off
lop
a chunk.
Lop off a bit of limestone.
Yeah, exactly. And what happened, though, is as Europe started to interact more with Western Africa, Europe had the technology to create glass for near zero cost. So you can imagine Europeans encountering this, saying it'd be the equivalent of us going to a country now where they take plastic as the divine payment. You can imagine, and you can, with 5 plastic bottles, buy a bar of gold. You imagine that sort of opportunity. Well, that's essentially the equivalent of what happened, really. So a lot of Europeans started to effectively flood the market with glass that they'd produced. But because this was such a large economy, the impact took a lot longer to be felt. And so there was the slow pilfering, really, of all the natural resources from a lot of Western Africa. And actually was arguably a big factor in leading to a lot of the slave trade out of Western Africa. Yeah.
Okay.
There's mixed records on this, as you could probably imagine, for 16th century, but that's indicatively a big cause factor of it. And so the impact was felt a lot more because it took so long for that loss of wealth, really, and sovereignty even, to be felt.
So there would have been cheap glass, easy to make, from Europe coming into that area.
Yep.
And being exchanged for hard assets like land,
yep,
and whatever, and maybe
metals
towards the end, yeah, people.
Yeah,
you're talking the slave trade.
Exactly. Yeah. So really, pretty tragic, but it's what happened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Interesting. So Yap Island and the rice stones, and West Africa and the agri beads.
Yeah.
And examples of
worth a dig into for those that are interested in a bit of history and diving more into it. But yeah, what it led to, well, actually, to be fair, the use of metal in money has predated a lot of those things quite likely. And the use of gold in particular is one of the longest attachments to use of money, to being a form of money of anything. And there's examples of this back to prior to ancient Rome, more than 2,000 years ago. And the reason why gold has been so highly used, and we talked a little bit about it last week, really, is, again, it's got a high stock-to-flow ratio. So the existing gold, very durable, virtually indestructible, virtually impossible to synthetically produce. And as a result, it's become a very reliable store of wealth. So historic civilizations for millennia have used it. And one of the good examples of this is in Rome, ancient Rome. So they used, Caesar actually was one of the first to really implement a bit of a gold standard, which is fascinating. Part of me wonders if whether maybe that is a contributor to some of the infamy, obviously the infamous death and his hubris. was a huge factor in history there, but also the involvement of gold in their history and the probably arguably a big contributor to the rise of Rome.
And what about the downfall though?
Yeah, well, basically what happened was they initially started with every coin having apparently 8 grams of gold in it. To give you a bit of an idea, a SIM card, average SIM card in a phone is, if you were to have that as gold, that'd be about a gram of gold. So you imagine kind of 8 SIM cards sort of mashed together and stacked. The coin itself would have had other metals in it, obviously, because gold is pretty malleable. And so it would have been a bit soft and flimsy if it was only gold in there, but had 8 grams of gold in it. And they made basically no changes to that for 75 years. Even after Caesar died, the successor took over. There was a whole bunch of political upheaval and change, but monetarily there was no change. But the downfall began really with Nero, infamous for the fiddle while Rome was on fire story.
Yep.
But he began collecting coins and then melting them down and reminting with 7.2 grams.
Of gold. Here we go. Yeah.
So 10%
just a little bit, just a little bit.
And wouldn't really easily be noticeable. Oh, we'll just take a little bit and then use it to be able to produce more gold coins, which we can use to fund things like our conquest of other countries. And the citizens are still happy because we're bringing in the wealth of these other places, and all of our Roman citizens are sharing in some of that. Anecdotally, Roman emperors wanted to be popular, and they at times implemented some somewhat recognizable forms of like monetary policy where they put maximum prices on foods and even gave away food for free at times. You can imagine what sort of impact that has if you're someone in the outskirts who is producing the food and you see, actually, I could just go to Rome, be a citizen there, and basically be getting what I'm producing for free. Why am I here in the field? Why don't I just go to Rome? And you do the math of if everyone starts doing that, who's producing the food that they're giving away for free?
Then that starts to get a little shaky.
Yeah.
At the foundational level. Yeah.
Exactly. And suddenly that popularity contest has a real cost and consequence to it, which is one that's tough. That's a decline that's tough to arrest and change. People get used to a certain standard. If you start dropping that standard of living, well, people aren't so happy. And so the solution is, oh, we'll just cut the content in the coin a little bit further and make some more coins and use that to...
Which is like an early inflation, isn't it?
Exactly right. Yeah, it is inflation. Inflation through reducing the quality of the money and increasing the supply. And for some people, this might sound a bit familiar.
It's printing money without the printing bit.
Exactly. It's the ancient form of printing money.
Yeah.
Exactly right. A bit more work involved because you're operating some mints to be able to form the coins and pump them out there. So it's not quite the same, but
I'm not good at math, but it seems to me if it what was the weight again? Original weight?
8 grams and then down to 7.2.
Okay, so that's
10%.
So every 10 or so, you're getting another coin.
Exactly, right.
Of the same value, potentially for a while, until people realize what's going on.
Exactly, yeah. And the other metals used in it would have been metals that were pretty low value, and so people wouldn't realize the same. But then after Nero, he wasn't the only one. We had Caracalla. I don't know if I pronounce it Caracalla, who reduced it to 6.5 grams. So again, effectively another 10%.
Here we go. Yep.
Basically. And then Diocletian down to 5.5 grams. And then he actually reduced it twice. He was a real money printer, Diocletian, down to 4.5 grams. And so we're almost half the original.
It would have been obvious at that point, right? It would have started to be, it would have had a different feel and different weights, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. But the thing at this point is this has taken a good 150, 200 years. It's so over that time frame, people don't know, they forget what their ancestors knew. And so it's a bit more surreptitious is probably the right word for it.
Yeah, I think it is. Yep.
the secondary coin they had in that day and age, which is, I guess, equivalent to our former one and two cent coins, which no longer exist, was the denarius, which was a silver coin. And the silver content in that got so low that basically the silver layer was pretty much just effectively a painted layer over the top. It would wear off and you'd see the brass copper underneath. And so eventually that coin pretty much just ceased to exist because people realized it was essentially worthless now.
Yeah. It more hassle to carry around, actually.
Yeah.
Than any value they give. I was in America beginning of the year, and of course you forget these things, and I don't use cash much, but I used a bit of cash there. And I was getting pennies and dimes back in my change, and you very quickly accumulate quite a few. And I'm thinking, crikey, that's right. We used to have ones and twos. They've still got them. It kind of blew me away to remember that, you know.
And they have more different denotions of coins. There's a large number of different.
There's the quarter, and then there's the nickel, and before you get to the, and there's still a dollar note. I mean, we gave up on the one and two notes, but they've still got the $1 note. Yeah.
Well, when you think about it in New Zealand dollar terms, it's especially interesting because, you know, $1, it's about $1.60 New Zealand. Most people wouldn't think it's practical, I guess, nowadays to have a $1.60 type note because, of course, we did away with the $1 and $2 notes. So, yeah, it is fascinating. And that's a good point as well. Obviously, no currency stays the same forever. Even hard currencies aren't always going to be hard currencies, and that's the trap some people can fall into, is that because something was a hard currency once, and I imagine these societies probably had the same issues where they thought, oh, this is a hard currency, you know, we are Rome, we're the power of the world, we are the world. But the impact of inflation, the slow creeping impact of inflation, was a huge factor in the fall of Rome.
So degrading of money systems kind of go in lockstep, let's say, generally, maybe.
Yes.
With the degrading of societies and civilizations.
I would say sort of track it. Yeah, I'd say it's absolutely fair. There is a lot of debate over this, of course, and there's always other factors involved, but very often when you see the decline of different societies, it has been as a result of economic policies, which has often involved changes in currency. And we'll talk a bit about it next week as well, and the gold standard that we used to have, kind of fast forwarding into the 20th century and late 19th century. There is a point where, you know, one country is trading and has gold coins that they're using as their currency. Like in Florence, they had the florin gold coin in I think the 13th century. You could trade that gold coin for the gold coin from another civilization because it's the same thing. It's just different. One might be 6 grams and the other's 10 grams. And so, you've got a very simple fixed exchange rate there, 6 to 10, and it doesn't change ever because it's the same thing. And that, can you imagine how much simpler it would be? We think about, you know, currency and all the crazy industry that is currency exchange, foreign exchange, and how many thousands, millions, blackly, of people involved in that industry for something that really is so pointless. Because all it is just converting one currency into another. Can you imagine if these people were actually doing something else? There's so many other more productive things that surely could be done with those people's time.
Yeah, that's an episode in of itself. Yeah. I was also thinking that to make those early exchanges, that would have been a real push to develop reliable weight and measure systems.
Yes.
You know, so you could accurately, and you'd have to be, as it became more and more developed, you'd have to have more and more accuracy in your weighing and measuring to get the, I don't know, the most reliable exchange going.
Yeah. Well, that's why often in movies depicting that era of the Roman Empire, times often depict the weighing of the currency using some standard weights to ensure that there's not a manipulation there. Because I guess if you're so used to the size that the coin should be and what it looks like, it'd be very difficult to cheat people on the weight side of things, like to make something that's not gold or not a denarius, for example, that looks the same, feels the same, and weighs the same, be very, very difficult. So I imagine, yeah, that was part of the monetary checks that would be part of normal life. It's a bit weird to think about. We don't go to the supermarket and the supermarket operator doesn't go, okay, you know, you're weighing your bananas, I'm going to weigh your $5 note here to make sure it's legitimate.
But they do use weights for, I think, bangs for counting coins, don't they?
Yes.
Because they know exactly,
Often those coin counting machines use a system of measuring weight in order to count coins in a very fast manner. Yeah.
All right. Anything more to say on... Well, we've got to money in metal. Anything more to say on that?
I think to close off, and I'll make a bit of a segue here. So going back to Rome, following the denarius and the kind of decline of the Roman Empire, there came an emperor called Constantine, who founded Constantinople in modern-day Turkey, and basically took the denarius and that same weight, 4.5 grams of gold, which the coin had gotten to then. They then established that as a currency, and it didn't change for about a millennia. And that happened alongside Constantinople being one of the most prosperous societies for all of that time frame, until basically an emperor then re-engaged in reducing the gold content, and here we go back, inflation again, the same old story.
Yep.
And the denarius, the name of it was transitioned to being called the solidus. I think it's interesting. We talk about solid and it's solid money or something that is solid and reliable. It then became known as the bezant as part of the Byzantine Empire. And interestingly, around the same time Islam was rising in the world, they actually took that same coin, basically essentially copied it into the Islamic dinar, which is still... used today.
Yeah, it's still there.
So it's fascinating that we have currency really that started probably about 1800 years ago at 4.5 grams. And today, to this day, often actually a lot of the measurements and the weight are the same. But the point I wanted to make is so often there's really good historic examples of civilizations that prospered because they had solid money, where there was no engaging of manipulation, of trying to change it. And I think that is the winding this back to the Bitcoin, which we'll talk about in a few episodes' time. That's where the hope is, I think, for a lot of people that are believers in Bitcoin, is that it provides a solid, unchangeable form of money, which will hopefully see a real age of prosperity. Is that too optimistic to hold?
Well, I guess if you look back on history, you might get the directional sort of slant on that, of where it might go, I guess, unless we update human behavior and thinking along the way, which we kind of do. So that is in there.
There are lots of other factors at play, and we'll get some of those as we go through the next few episodes. But hopefully that's helpful for people to get a bit of a history lesson, some stories.
On a bit of a light note to end, I was thinking of the Flintstones.
Yes.
When we're talking there, and the currency that they had, because they bought things and exchanged things, and just at the end here, I've looked it up. They had cloth.
Okay.
They had the slab dollar bills. Okay. Clams. We mentioned shells before.
Yeah.
And rocks were the equivalent of coins.
Yeah, interesting. Well, I mean, they've really just, I imagine the producers probably just looked at some of these historic forms of money and threw them all together. Because seashells was actually a form of currency in North America in the 1700s until, again, realized it was not hard currency.
And the limestone, rocks.
Yeah.
There you go.
Slab dollar bills. I like it.
Yeah. What's that in slab dollar bills, Barney? Yeah. All right. Another really interesting chat as part of our What is Money series, Ep 2. So just remind us again, what are we going to be looking at next Monday, do you think, Joel?
Next Monday, it's going to be a look at the gold standard. and how we've kind of transitioned or where modern money has come from.
Okay. Look forward to that. Thanks, Joel. Really interesting. We'll see you in a week.
Thanks, Paul. My pleasure.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.